Well, good morning and welcome to my little introduction overview of Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. I like to do these periodically where I take a book from the Providence curriculum and share it with you. And inevitably, some of your children will have had this book, or they're going to have the book, and you kind of want to know. They bring it home to you. They talk to you about it. You kind of want to know what's going on. Why is your son or daughter as excited about this as work as they are? And generally, we have great success with this book. One of the great things about the religion program. When you're in science, when you're in math, you're sort of under the authority of like the establishment, right? There are textbooks. You've got to hit these things. There are all these external, standards that you got to hit, and so you're kind of limited in terms of what books you can use and whatnot. And one of the great things for us is that we are able to pick books that connect with students, so that that our students read C.S. Lewis. How did that come about? That came about because we tried Mere Christianity, and we tried the Screwtape Letters, and we tried The Great Divorce. We tried these books, and they took off. Students liked them. They got into them. They argue about them. It works. That's one of the great things. And we don't use those books because somehow we're just trying to like be way up here. There you can't evangelize with textbooks. I realize most of the Catholic schools in this archdiocese and those high schools are using textbooks, but I assure you, nobody has looked back and thought, "Oh, I came to Christ when it was on the third chapter of the Sadlier edition on the second. Oh, it was that St. Mary's Press book. And remember one of the illustrations, there was a girl under a tree thinking, and I just thought, that girl could be me." Nobody has come to some kind of inner realization of faith through a textbook. But we have kids who come back to us and say, it was reading the Mere Christianity that I realized that this religion of mine makes sense. Or it was when I was reading the Screwtape Letters that I realized I was making choices that were putting me in a wrong direction. I had a girl who told me it was reading The Death of Ivan Illich by Tolstoy. If you're not familiar with that book, it's basically this guy who he sort of lives for status and comfort and money and getting on in the world. And in the book, he gets very, very ill and eventually dies. But it's during that illness that he's sort of brought to the realization that, he's lived for things which are just transient and ultimately aren't satisfying him. This 17-year-old girl told me, "I realized reading that book that I was seeing myself in a mirror, that I could end up like this guy. I could be someone who just lived for status and pleasure and comfort, and I didn't want to be that person." So it's because of the impact of the books that we use. That's why we use them. That's why 10th, 11th, 12th grade, we use the books we do. So this is a book that we read early on in junior year. There's this brief unit which we have on kind of a psychological approach to happiness. And by psychological, I mean when you, in psychology, you determine happiness by kind of reported self-satisfaction, right? You ask people, are you happy with your life, right, about this or that? And David Myers is the person we read, and he's written whole books on these topics, but he's very good on how it is that standard of living is not something that automatically generates self-reported happiness. So in other words, when you look at the people who are in the Fortune 500 and you ask them, how happy are you with your life? Their reports of their own happiness are only marginally higher than the general population. Myers is the one where I first read that if you're talking about people in that first, let's say, $50,000 of income, in other words, you didn't really know where you were going to live or have a reliable source of food, and now you got a roof over your head and a chicken in the pot. yeah, you're going to be pretty happy. But once you get beyond that, there is no clear relationship between growth and income and growth and happiness. That happiness is much more related to things that have to do with friendships, relationships, your work, your marriages. Those are things that are much more definitive of happiness. So after we spend a little time on that, they read The Death of Ivan Illich, which kind of drives, in a way, that point home through a narrative. And then the next thing they read is Man's Search for Meaning. Man's Search for Meaning replaced a book that I tried about 15 years ago, maybe a little less than that, Boethius' Consolation of Philosophy. Boethius is something that I read in college and I connected with, and I remember talking to Bill Stevenson about it, and he was open to the idea. And if you're not familiar with the book, Boethius, he's a kind of a later church father. He gets thrown in prison through a false accusation. It really is kind of political jockeying around, and he loses everything. This is somebody who was he had political power, he had education, he had status, he had wealth, and so on. And now he's in prison, and eventually he's executed. And medieval stories. This is kind of early, kind of early Middle Ages, if you like, but more Dark Ages. There's always personification. So philosophy is Lady Philosophy. It's this woman who comes in as philosophy, and she throws out the muses. The muses are, of course, these girls who are trying to console them with poetry and music, and she just throws them out. And, of course, she is talking about Dame Fortune. And if you think of the Wheel of Fortune, not Vanna White, that you get carried up, right, by fortune. You get, power or wealth or whatnot. But this wheel, it carries you up, and then eventually, right, it's going to bring you down. And it has nothing to do with you being a good person or a bad person. That's how fortune works. We tried that book for a couple of years, and it just didn't work. There were some students that connected with it, but it wasn't doing the job. So I remembered this book. When I was at Boston College, Father Arthur Madigan had a class that he would do for freshmen, and a big part of the class was Aristotle's Ethics. But before he read the Ethics, he would have students read this book, Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And I remember at the time thinking, what are you doing that for? What do you need Viktor Frankl? There's Aristotle. He's the great thinker. Just go straight to Aristotle. And after reading this book and thinking about it, because I remembered kind of the storyline, I thought, well, I had this book where it was somebody having taken everything away from him and trying to figure out where does my life go? What's life about? Well, that Frankl, that's kind of his narrative. I'll give that a try. And looking back now, I realize what a work of pedagogical genius it was on Father Madigan's part to do that. And that's basically what we do. They read Man's Search for Meaning, and then the next thing they read is the Ethics. And the reason is this. You've already talked about how it is that wealth and money, status, and so on, those are not things that where there's a clear relationship to happiness. And now we have the book where all of that is taken away. There's no money or wealth or status or power. You couldn't be poorer or enjoy less status or be more powerless than a prisoner in Auschwitz. Okay, and what happens is that students are by being brought into this world, it really forces you to think about what is it, what kind of value, what kind of worth would my life have if all those things were gone? Right? That forces you to think about is there any joy? Is there any purpose to life, in fact, if you can't have those things? And the thing that Viktor Frankl comes to is, in fact, there can be a kind of blessing in losing those things, because it forces you to realize this inner world of human life. Right? So often, the reason that we focus on power and wealth and status and so on as human happiness, they're easy to see. right? You can see the new car. You can see the big house. You can see the promotion. You can see the inauguration seminar, ceremonies. You come to power. But this inner world of what would make for human happiness in our minds and wills and hearts, that's not something that's seeable in the same way. It's harder to get. I first encountered Frankl's thinking years ago through hearing Archbishop Fulton Sheen talk about Carl Jung. He talked about Jung, and he talks, I think, about Frankl. I think he may have spent more time with Jung. But this is where I first heard this term, existential neurosis. And what existential neurosis means, Frankl was a practicing psychiatrist. And his experiences in Auschwitz changed his approach. They changed his approach to carrying out psychiatry. Because he realized in the camps, what seems to be keeping people alive is not whether they're bigger or tougher or stronger. What seems to be keeping people alive is that they have some kind of ultimate purpose and meaning that's carrying them forward. That purpose and meaning could be a relationship. It could be their marriage or their family. Both Frankl and his wife were brought to the camps. They were separated. And he will talk periodically about his hope of being united with his wife. In fact, there are these beautiful passages where he talks about having her in a way be present to him in his mind and his heart and his imagination, even though she's physically not there. And in the end, she did not survive. He survived the camps. She did not. It could be a family purpose. It could be a religious purpose. Frankl will talk about God. He was raised Jewish. It's not clear from the book that he's practicing or observant, but clearly he has a Hebrew or Jewish upbringing that has stuck with him, some of the scriptures have stuck with him and the prayers have stuck with him, and that he does think of God as real, and that he sees people who make that as a priority, or dedicate their lives to that's real purpose and meaning. Could be work, could be some kind of career, some kind of job you have. He will talk about these people who, you know, they're engineers, and they're still thinking about their engineering. Or as he was in the camps as a psychiatrist, he's making all these observations, and he's writing them down on little scraps of paper and hiding them in his clothes. His work is still important to him, and he hopes to survive to, like, write this book. You know, that was something that carried him through. But in other words, what's more important for human beings is not so much what they have materially or what they're doing in some sort of profession or whatnot. That especially when everything is stripped from you, the thing that will ultimately carry you through is, do you have some kind of, do you see some purpose and meaning to your life? You know, just in who you are and just in what it is that you've been given. And fundamentally, the problem with so many modern people, this is what Fulton Sheen is drawing from Jung and people like Jung and Frankl, their psychological problems are not really because of some kind of upbringing or feeling unloved or feeling unaffirmed or some kind of childhood trauma. No, they're unhappy because really they have no purpose and meaning to their lives. One of the things that he talks about in this last section, if you have this edition, most of this is the narrative of being in the camps and kind of the realizations that he's coming to. The last 20 pages or so are kind of an afterword where he's reflecting more on how he incorporated into his psychiatric practice. And one of the examples that he will give is, I forget what it's called exactly, it's like Sunday morning depression. So here you are, you have you work, you have your busyness of the week, but then it comes to the weekend, you don't have some kind of job that gives you meaning or purpose, you don't see that in your relationships, you aren't religious, and so Sunday, therefore, just becomes a kind of a vacuum. It just becomes this empty space. And unless you are kept busy, you just feel the sort of emptiness of your life. So here it is. He's seeing these people in his practice. They think, I'm depressed, like I'm clinically depressed, or I have some psychological problem. And he has to help these people understand, no, your problem is you don't know what your life is about. That's what your problem is. You don't have something to live for. Your problem is not your relationship with your mother, your father. That's not what your problem is. One of the things that I think it strikes the adults more than the kids reading it is Frankl's use of Nietzsche. Nietzsche, the Gott ist tot, right? The God is dead guy? What is Nietzsche doing in here? You know, when you're 16, you don't really know who this guy is. You hear the expression, that which does not kill me makes me stronger, and you think it's Kelly Clarkson. So, you know, you don't know it's this 19th century, you know, German philosopher. Anyway, so what is Nietzsche doing in here? And this is one of the things that I think in terms of understanding the discipline of psychology that I think many people are simply unaware of. Psychology, the form of psychology that we call depth psychology. So this includes Freud, Adler, Maslow, these people. These folks who really are sort of pioneers of the field. It's no accident that they're all German, and it's no accident that when you look at their early writing and you look at the way they describe how they came to what they're doing and so on, the two names that you see over and over again are Schopenhauer and Nietzsche. So modern psychology flows out of modern philosophy. And that is something that doesn't mean that modern psychology is fundamentally flawed, but it does mean that you have to understand that when you're reading things in Freud and Maslow and Adler and those folks, you are not talking about things that are, as it were, scientific in the sense that they all come out of just experience, experiment, observation. No, all that stuff is front-loaded with a whole host of philosophic assumptions. There are all sorts of assumptions about the mind, the emotions. In fact, think about these very terms. Conscious, unconscious, subconscious. All of that comes out of Freud. That comes out of the general theory of psychoanalysis. And that's something that now we all consider almost sort of self-evident, almost like a kind of a psychological fact or a scientific fact. But what comes into Freud from Nietzsche and Schopenhauer is that our ordinary lived social life is this, there's like this surface level of rationality, but it's all on the surface. What's below that is fundamentally irrational. It's all drives, it's all impulses, and that's the real deal. That's what's really going on in human life. All the interactions that are rational, explainable, decent, moral, that's all appearance. The reality is the urges, impulses, drives, that human action is fundamentally animal and irrational. Okay? So, in fact, you'll hear some of the terms in here with Freud, will to pleasure. And that's something that Frankl wants to transcend. But that goes back to Nietzsche, will to power, Willensmacht, the will to power, which is in turn a new variation on what Schopenhauer described as the will to life. Okay? In other words, in all of these, that human life is fundamentally driven by appetite and by will. And that whatever is going on that looks sort of moral or social or rational, that's fundamentally appearance. That's appearance. So Nietzsche can seem strange to you, but in the world of psychology as a developing discipline, these are where its roots are from. Okay, these are where its roots are from. And I will say this: where Frankl uses Nietzsche, I think he uses Nietzsche in ways that work, because he sees the problem that Nietzsche rightly sees. So let me explain briefly what I mean by that, what Nietzsche sees. The expression that, you know, most educated adults know from Nietzsche, God is dead. Very often you don't know the whole rest of that quote. God is dead and we have killed him. How shall we be worthy of this murder, the greatest of all murders? How shall we wash our hands, the bloody knives that we have used? Right? We have killed God. Now, obviously, during the Passion, isn't there a way in which that's true? Right? That, but for Nietzsche, what that means is our belief in modern science, our belief in modern rationality, our belief in sort of modern politics, we have really ditched the idea of there being some kind of supernatural authority up there. We don't really believe that anymore. Our lives had meaning and purpose because we thought there was a Father, Son, Holy Spirit. We thought there was a God that took on human nature, came to earth, suffered and died for men. We thought there was something he established that gave us guidance in life and offered us salvation. We don't believe that anymore. Okay? And when he says we, he's talking that means we educated Europeans. We educated Europeans have bought into Marx. We've bought into Darwin. We've bought into modern science. We've bought into kind of materialism. We think we bought into mechanism. In other words, we just think the universe is one physiochemical machine running along on necessary laws. We don't really think that there's some kind of divine being behind that anymore. Nietzsche is the first writer that greets that with anguish. Okay? In fact, a lot of contemporary people, they just think, well, if there isn't a God, it doesn't really make any difference anymore. We just treat each other nice and show up at work and, you know, eat healthy meals and for feeling down, get a serotonin boost. You know, life goes on as before. But Nietzsche was the one who understood if there is no God, then we face an empty, purposeless, meaningless universe. We come into existence by chance, and we go out of existence by biochemical necessity. There's nothing that redeems human life. We're just animals, and we're pathetic animals because we've risen above the level of just right eating, sleeping, mating, dying. We've got all these ideas. We've got, you know, all of these things sort of raise us above it. And yet, where does it go? Nowhere. So Nietzsche is someone who's worth raising here because Nietzsche is the one who raises this problem of meaning and purpose. And what Nietzsche's alternative or Nietzsche's solution is, in a way, what we have to do is invent purpose and meaning. We have to invent purpose and meaning. We have to create purpose and meaning. Because we don't believe there's any God-given purpose and meaning. We used to believe that. We don't have that consolation anymore. So what Frankl then takes from Nietzsche is, I don't think he buys into Nietzsche's atheism or whatnot, but or will to power. But what he takes from Nietzsche is the importance of purpose and meaning for human life. Nietzsche is having this crisis because he thinks that religion, theology, revelation, that's all false. Frankl is open to there being revelation, is open to there being a God. And he recognizes this important thing that Nietzsche emphasizes. Human life can't move forward unless there's meaning and purpose. Okay? So the two things that he quotes from Nietzsche, if a man has a why, he can find any how. Right? If you've got a purpose, then you can, as it were, direct the rest of your life in light of that purpose. You can make it. And that's a quote that he reflects on. The other quote, of course, is that which does not kill me makes me stronger, right? And he even quotes it in German, okay? And again, by overcoming difficulties in light of a purpose, this can strengthen you, okay? So one of the things that I was just with sophomores reading the Screwtape Letters, letter number 8 is where he talks about peaks and troughs. This is what Screwtape describes as the law of undulation. That any aspect of your life, your work life, your relationships, you know, for them, their student life, there are these ups and downs. Things are going well, you're focused, you have energy, you have enthusiasm, and right, it goes down. And Lewis, through Screwtape, very wisely points out that it's in the trough points of a faith life, those are the most important for spiritual growth. The spiritual growth doesn't happen when it's all energy, enthusiasm, and joy. It tends to happen when you are like powering your way through. Okay, and I will tell students the thing about that can be hard for you to understand. It could be that when you think of religious life, like you're going to church because your parents are taking you by the ear, right? They're taking you by the ear to church, and so from your point of view, it could all be trough, right? It's never enjoyable. I'm being made to do this. And so, but I said, the thing that you can do is then you look at religious people and you think that somehow it's all peak, right? They're doing this because they enjoy it. No. You have to understand where there's any sort of serious faith commitment or faith life, it's up and down. I said, the people, when you're in a sport, it's not like, oh, right, you are enjoying it the whole time. You are dragging yourself through drills and practice and all the rest of it. I was dumb enough to think, when I was a teenager, that the girls, I called them the 4.0 girls, these girls who were the really good students in my high school, they were doing homework because they enjoyed doing homework. Okay, I was dumb enough to believe that. Because I just thought, if you did something all the time, you must be doing it because you enjoyed it. Nope. These girls had a goal of getting into Smith, of getting into Stanford, of getting into these elite schools. And by gum, even if they hated calculus, they were going to do it, and they were going to do it every night. That was a foreign thought to me. But where you have real commitment, that doesn't mean constant enjoyment. It means that you are able to keep going even when you're in those troughs. And so when he talks about that which does not kill me makes me stronger, that you are able to make it through the troughs, that you are able to make it through the low points, that's what strengthens your will. And it's a terrible thing when people are simply allowed to just quit the moment that they get to the bottom, because then they don't have that experience of their will being strengthened. The importance of the interior life. This is one of the things for which I think the book is especially helpful for when you're young. When you're young, it's hard to have an interior life. Now, when I say it's hard to have an interior life, well, what do you mean? My daughter writes in her journal and her diary all the time. Okay, yes, but chances are what she's writing is the impressions that all the things in the day are making on her. There's a wonderful expression in Max Shaler, who's a contemporary in the 1920s and 30s. Shaler will talk about how it is that human being or animals live ecstatically. And when he uses that term ecstatically, animals live entirely impacted by the sense impressions and sense experiences that are happening around them. So where there's something to be excited about or aroused by or in fear of, the animal's active. But where there's no outside stimulus, right, the animal just powers down. So think about your dog. If you've got that dog that the neighbors come over, you know, somebody drives up, or he's hungry, or you're about to go for a walk, man, that dog is all over the place. But if nobody's showing up, he already ate, you're not going to take him for a walk, right? Dog just powers down. He's got nothing to do. You might notice that with your teenage boy, too. No friends are come over, he's run out of texts, he doesn't have football, right? He just powers down. There's nothing to do. And that's sort of how we are naturally. But to have an interior life means there is something going on within you in terms of your thoughts, your memories, your imagination, your thinking, that isn't related necessarily to what's happening in front of you at all. In fact, to have a genuine interior life means it's something that you're carrying with you that, in fact, very often you could be using as a kind of resource when what in front of you is either totally boring or distressing or frightening or all of the above. So that he treasures these memories of his wife, and that he meditates on his wife. That's not something because he just saw her that morning, or, right, they've been apart for months, and then that turns into years. But he has this inner world of cherishing his experiences with her. There's another scene that he talks about where this woman, she's in the camps, and I think at a certain point she's sick and she's dying. And she's looking out her window, and there's this tree outside her window. And she just talks about how it is, this tree is my only companion. This tree is my only friend now. And she talks about how it is that when I was, you know, before I came to the camps, when I was in my kind of ordinary life, I was very self-centered, I was very spoiled. And in a way, this experience has allowed me to, you know, to let go of that. And you can tell that what's happened with this woman is it's not like she went to therapy and the counselor told her this, or she went with a friend to coffee and they had a good talk. And no, this is something that she has had to work out within herself for herself. And she can talk about the tree as a kind of companion in a way, but she has had some kind of inner dialogue. Okay? This is one of the things in the senior year when seniors read Augustine. And I tell seniors this because of the experience I had at Boston College. There was a section of the Confessions we taught that I taught that because it was in the Reader, Book 11, and it's the one on time. But I had students who they objected to the very way that the Confessions was written. He's talking to God, and it's like you're overhearing him. It's not like he's talking to you. In fact, I remember this one Boston College kid. It's like, oh God this, no God that, and you know, why are we listening in on this prayer? And I had to help him understand how it is that prayer is an inner dialogue. That all of us, to some degree, have an inner dialogue. All of us have some inner conversations going on with our life. And to have an interior life means that more and more, God is a part of that inner dialogue. That initially, it may be that God is something that you are dialoguing with yourself about, but as you grow deeper into spiritual life, that God becomes more and more of a participant in that dialogue. In other words, that you are regularly talking with him. So if you don't have an interior life and an interior dialogue, which God is a part of it, you pick up Augustine's Confessions and it's just jarring. It's just jarring. But I said, you have to understand, this is what the Christian life looks like. You're thinking of the Christian life as if it were predominantly exterior things. I go to church. I fold my hands together in prayer. I receive the sacraments. Those are important, but none of that would get anywhere unless there was an interior life that was behind that. So that's one of the things that that students can see in Frankl is when you have an interior life, it gives you resources, again, when everything around you is collapsed. One of the things that I worry for our young people is because the electronics are so important to them, I worry that it drains their capacity for an interior life. Because you're living ecstatically all the time. Oh, I'm keeping up on my friend, my story, or I'm keeping up on these pictures, or I'm communicating with them, right? How do you have that inner dialogue? How do you have that inner conversation with yourself if you're constantly, as it were, talking to 20 other people all the time, or just going from one TikTok video to the next, to the next, to the next. By the way, it's remarkable how many of the students will be very frank with you that they're aware that they are chemically addicted. They are aware that they're getting little gets of dopamine and whatnot when they do it. They know it. They know at some level they're addicted, but that doesn't stop you from being addicted. It doesn't change your behavior. So that's one of my concerns, in fact, about teaching an interior life. As the years go by, will this be harder and harder for students to understand because they never really have a moment for an interior life? All of us have things that we want to wave a wand. Like, if we go around teachers' meetings, if there's one thing you could change about the school, to go back to the rule that there were no phones between 8 and 3:15. If I could wave a wand, that's what I would do. But it's almost impossible. Why? Because of the parents. Number five, is meaning of life subjective or objective? I raise this because there's this moment in Frankl that can look sort of like relativism. It's a beautiful passage, but let's see where it is. It's where he's talking about. Yeah, here we go. If you have this edition, this is 76 to over to 77, and it's worth quoting. What was really needed was a fundamental change in our attitude toward life. We had to learn ourselves, and furthermore, we had to teach despairing men that it did not really matter what we expected from life, but rather what life expected from us. We needed to stop asking about the meaning of life and instead to think of ourselves as those who were being questioned by life daily and hourly. Our answer must consist not in talk and meditation, but in right action and right conduct. Life ultimately means taking responsibility to find the right answer to its problems and to fulfill the tasks which it constantly sets for each individual. Okay? Now, hearing that sounds like, okay, that could be something just objective, right? That there's meaning in life that we've got to figure out, and what does life expect from us? But as you keep reading, life does not mean something vague, but something real and concrete, just as life's tasks are also very real and concrete. They form man's destiny, which is different and unique for each individual. No man and no destiny can be compared with any other man or any other destiny. Okay, that sounds relativistic, right? That like each person is finding their own meaning, but you have to kind of take the book as a whole, because Frankl will talk about forgiveness. He will talk about bravery. He will talk about rising above animal conditions. You know, plainly, there's a whole set of moral actions or moral behaviors that he considers belongs to everyone. So what does he mean by that? Probably a way to think about it, it's like perhaps in spiritual language, the way you talk about discernment, like discernment of a vocation. Am I called to religious life? Am I called to marry? Am I called to marry this person? Am I being called to this kind of work or that kind of work? Notice that even with a belief in the theological virtues, the cardinal virtues, and so on, you still think there's this way in which each person uniquely is being called out to live out those theological virtues, or each person is uniquely being called, being expected to live out the cardinal virtues. So when he talks about a meaning of life being different from individuals, he's not saying, you're called to be an insurance salesman. You are called to be an assassin. You are called to be, right? It's not like that. It's that how it is that you are called to live out what is distinctly human in you, how you are supposed to be brave or generous or selfless or hopeful, that's going to be different for you than it is for the person next to you. Being married, what kind of job you have, in his case being a psychiatrist, those are the things. So it's not just the way that we talk about God's will for you, follow God's law. It's what's God's will for you? What is God calling you to do in your particular, giving the particular gifts that he's given to you, given the particular ways or opportunities that he's opened to you? Okay, and that's obviously what he's doing in his therapy, is helping people understand what is your unique purpose. I can't help you, especially in a therapeutic session, but just telling, be brave, be just, be selfless. No, what does that mean for me, given who I am and given my place? Okay, so therefore, where he ends is helping people understand that this is what it is that has to be guiding their life. You know, that in fact, they're not going to be living a complete human life unless they're aware of their acting for some kind of purpose, of the need for meaning in their lives. I want to leave time for your questions and comments, but let me just end with this one thing. I don't watch television and movies as I did, let's say 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And part of the reason that I don't, part of it is I think I just don't have as much time, but part of the reason I don't is I just feel as though there are so many modern dramas where really the thing that Frankel is describing is exactly what I'm seeing. I feel as though I see more and more narratives where the characters really have no ultimate purpose and meaning to their lives. They don't know why they're there. By the way, there's a remarkable book by a former teacher of mine from Boston College, Thomas Hibbs. He's now at Baylor. And the book is called Shows About Nothing. And the starting point for the book is talking about Seinfeld, which was, as you remember, was enormously successful. But remember, within the storyline itself, right, Seinfeld is proposing his own show to NBC. And the way he describes it is a show about nothing. That's how he sells that show. I mean, with kind of his own brand of humor. And Hibbs takes that as a kind of entry point because he says that is not something unique to Jerry Seinfeld. And it, in fact, it's pretty insightful on Seinfeld's part. There's so much of modern narrative where characters, in a way, are just drifting. They don't know what their lives are about. They don't know where they're going. They can make jokes about it. They can cry about it, but none of them ever solve it. They never have the sense of where this is all heading, and they have no inner resources. They've drifted away from their families. They've drifted away from any kind of belief in religion. They're serious enough to know that their jobs don't really just provide some kind of ultimate purpose and meaning. They can't just, in other words, just thoughtlessly work in the business world or the legal world or some world like that. But then they're stuck. They ultimately don't know where it's going. So the problem of meaning is something that saturates a lot of modern entertainment. I find it kind of difficult to watch. There's something very unsatisfying about a narrative that can never resolve, because ultimately the people who are in it don't know how to resolve their own lives. Questions that or comments that you may have on any of this? Go ahead, Mrs. Azarian.
I just found it interesting reading. You know, he's saying about having this meaning in life and having a purpose, but yet the atrocities that he's seen and experienced. During his time at the camps, he's desensitized to a lot of stuff too, and talks very openly about that, and not having a problem with wearing some corpse's clothes.
Yes.
And seeing some people, suffering, and that it's kind of like a switch, a survival mechanism almost.
Yes.
For him to become desensitized to the suffering of others.
Remember, he quotes Dostoevsky, I think, at one point, and that's what he observes, that man is the being that can get used to anything. And somebody quotes that, and somebody else in the camp hears that quote and says, yes, it's true, but don't ask us how. Dostoevsky himself was somebody who was imprisoned. He was in a czarist prison. I think that the narrative about that is called The House of the Dead. But Dostoevsky also talks about how it is that was an important experience for him, and in a way it gave him a kind of seriousness about life that he did not have as a young man. that he didn't have. So he talks about that as a formative experience. Mrs. Warner?
There was part of the book in the second half where he was talking about this U.S. military man who comes to him for a therapy for a visit because he'd been having psychotherapy and they told him, you don't hate your job, even though he didn't like his job.
It's your relationship with your father.
And all this. And he's kind of like, no, you just need a different job.
And he quits his job and gets another job and he's very happy.
Right. And so he kind of, what he said, he said is, sometimes you don't have a neurosis, you just have a struggle.
Right.
And having some struggles is actually a good thing.
Yep.
And it can lead to greater fulfillment or greater meaning. And so I think about that as you talked about at the beginning, like with our kids and sophomores and sophomores and juniors. Like, how do you talk to them about, like, it's okay if some things are just hard and it doesn't mean nothing's wrong?
Yes. Yeah. By the way, I mean, you say exactly that. In fact, I remember my father telling me at one point when I was 15 or 16 years old, if you're just like feeling awkward or sort of feeling unhappy, feeling you don't fit in, welcome to being 15. Yeah. You know? And if the other 15-year-olds are telling you somehow they don't have any of that, they're lying. People will tell you. In fact, I remember this very, very vividly because there was some song that was popular about how wonderful it was to be 16, and that's the goal, that's the best time of your life. I remember going home to my father and saying that, and he says, not only is that a lie, but I just think you're going to make kids suicidal if you tell them that this is sort of the peak of their life. He said, it's true. I mean, whatever you have now is, I've said this before, but it's worth repeating, that You can look at being a teenager, and you've got your mortgage that you're worried about, and you've got the budget that you've worried about, and maybe there's some marital things going on, and you've got neighbors, and there are things at work. Oh, if only I was 16 when I was carefree. You don't remember. All that means is that you don't remember. Whatever was going on at 16 with your school, your friends, your parents, you were just as worked up about that as you are about the house mortgage. Only the problem is now you have more resources on the inside. You've got more mentally and emotionally to handle these, big problems that you have than you did when you were 16 and the problems weren't all that big. So the message that my father had for me was, you're going to struggle, but you're going to be an adult. It will get better. You're going to be an adult and we'll get better. Not because everything out there gets better. You'll be better in here. And that sometimes I think is what we need to help our young people understand. It's not a matter of things out there. It's what's in here. And as parents, teachers, and so on, we are trying to help you grow up and to be an adults, which means not just that you're like bigger and you can vote and buy cigarettes and alcohol and all that. It means you are able to direct and govern your own life. You are able to run your own life. That's the key to being an adult. Thank you. Next week, I'll be giving another talk, and this one, a tribute to my father, which I've entitled "The Anthropologist Who Hated Relativism." Do I need to say anything more? The Anthropologist Who Hated Relativism.